Welcome to the Italian Renaissance Podcast, where we discuss the culture and art of 15th and 16th century Italy. I'm your host, Lawrence Ginangeli. Andiamo avanti. Renaissance people, what is going on? I hope my listeners in the United States had a restful long weekend to bring in the summer, and that everyone else can find the time to binge some art history podcasts as you enjoy the warm weather in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm doing a bit of a split episode today, something old and something new, for the sole purpose that the holiday weekend was unproductive in terms of the podcast. I'm giving tours on the weekends, and for many of us, the end of the semester involves exams and research and a lot of grading. So with that in mind, I'm going unscripted today, with a couple of exceptions, to finish our discussion about Giorgione da Castelfranco, looking mainly at his last work, The Sleeping Venus, or the Dresden Venus. And then I want to address some of the hot topics that I've received in terms of your guys' comments, emails, the reviews you leave online for the show, and all of the direct messages that I get from you lovely listeners. So, two episodes ago, we discussed the history and life of Giorgione, and we related his kind of poetic mood of painting to the portrait of Laura. And then, in the last episode, I sat down and talked with Professor Monica Schmitter about Giorgione's Tempest and the complications involved with trying to define that work. Some of those figures are going to come up again today. I'm going to issue a bit of a graphic content warning, okay? So what we're talking about is nude figures, so I'm not entirely sure that I'm actually going to be able to post these to the Instagram in their entirety. I will try, for whatever risk that may embed for me, especially given all of this nonsensical Florida hubbub about Michelangelo and, you know, these idiotic things that people are saying and doing about fine art and what the nude is, but also in that there is a little bit of explicit eroticism in these works, less so in Giorgione, and we're going to get on to Titian as well. But I just want to let people know, if you're listening to this with your kids in the car and you don't want them to hear about naked women, that now's the time to pause it until you're by yourself. But also because I don't think I can actually post these images. So if you're going to look them up, have in mind what you're doing. Not that I in any way endorse the censoring of nudity, especially in art, but that's going to be part of our conversation today. So, without further ado, we are going to talk about Giorgione's last work, The Sleeping Venus. This painting was left unfinished upon his death in 1510. So, remember, we have those records that he probably died and was buried in Lazaretto Vecchio, in quarantine from the plague that came through Venice in that time. So Giorgione died a young man in 1510 of plague. He left this painting unfinished. So it is recorded in the collection of Girolamo Marcello by someone you should be familiar with, Marc Antonio Michiel, in 1525. If you remember, Michiel was the sort of documenting art history sort of figure that Professor Schmitter was studying when she came across his interesting description of the Tempest. Okay, so Michiel records the painting in Marcello's inventory, so we know he possibly commissioned it. I don't think the jury is out on that one. Or, wait, how's that expression go? I think the jury is out on that one. In any case, we don't know for sure. There's a lot of worthwhile speculation, though. So, very importantly, the Dresden Venus, the Sleeping Venus of Giorgione, is the first large-scale reclining female nude of the Renaissance. They say in all of Western art. I don't know if I buy that, but in the very least, this is a mode of painting the nude female form that we should be relatively familiar with. However, this was the first of the Renaissance. And of course, because we're in Venice, at the turn from the kind of early Renaissance to what we define as the High Renaissance, we are really in a full-fledged reference to the classical world. And the one sculpture particularly cited in this case, especially by Nichols, that book that I'm always quoting because it's so marvelous, I'll probably do a review of it, is the Sleeping Ariadne in the Vatican. So often, this reclining, if it's a Venus, if it's a whoever, it's referred to as a sleeping Ariadne or a reclining Ariadne pose. Ariadne being a different figure from mythology. It is just the pose of the nude female body kind of reclining in sleep. So if we look at the painting itself, what you will see is a reclining nude female figure embedded in a sort of landscape. And her body is modeled in a sort of way that it sort of resembles a sculptural model rather than a live human model, because realistically, females were not posing nude for artists in this period. Men could do it, females could not. So they're probably referencing nude classical sculpture. Again, the Sleeping Ariadne in the Vatican is the one that Nichols cites for this painting. I haven't confirmed or denied whether a drawing or a copy, or if Giorgione went to Rome. I'm not entirely sure about those details. In any case, it is a direct reference to classical antiquity. Venus, as Ariadne, this sort of earthly mother goddess of beauty. There's a whole bit on that by the scholar Mary Gerard, if you want to hunt that down, why she's just sleeping in the field, right? It's a little bizarre. So let's take a look at this, and I'm going to try to describe this in the best terms possible, the painting and kind of what we're looking at here. So we have a nude female form laying in the landscape. She's got this sort of large red pillow behind her in beautifully, modeled draperies underneath her that, she seems to be kind of sleeping on top of, and there's a good reason for that. There's a backdrop behind her, rolling hills and trees, and this kind of like farm structure. So we're looking at something that's referring to a couple of types of poetry. We're talking pastoral poetry, this type of bucolic, feel the farmy sort of poetry, but also we're referencing Venus, a more classical poetry, and we are referencing a type of classical and contemporary Renaissance marriage poems called epithalamium, which I wrote down and probably said very, very incorrectly. So this really recalls all of those at the same time, right? So it's like an eroticized, mythological, marriage, pastoral painting that is accommodating a large variety of types of literature, which we talked about with Laura. This is always happening with Giorgione, right? She seems to lay up against this landscape, which I can't tell if that's supposed to be where she's propped up against, or if that's more of a backdrop. You have this kind of distant landscape as well that's hazy and blue, and these clouds coming in, much like what we saw in The Tempest, but it's not a tempest. It's just a kind of nice, you know, ethereal sort of day. So in addition to that, her arm is up, she's hairless, like a sculpture. We keep coming back to this. It's sculptural. And her other hand sort of comes around to her genital region, and her fingers are kind of curled up, but she's sleeping. So the eroticization is a little bit muted, but not entirely. And she's referencing an image that could have come right out of a text that we have talked about before when we discussed the sculpture of Tullio Lombardo and his Cadoro relief, the Hypnerotomachia Polyphili by Francesco Colonna, who also features a reclining female nude Venus, who, and it's a woodblock print, right? So this is the first, you know, full-scale painting of the reclining nude. He did this in a woodblock for a text. And it is accompanied by, so she's laying there, she's sleeping, and it's accompanied by a satyr who, in the most delicate terms possible, is excited to see her. So what Giorgione is doing is he's taking this kind of known, established erotic image, and he's reducing it. There's none of that. You are meant to appreciate the nude as an art and understand the erotic undertones that have to do with Venus as a goddess of love and beauty, that has to do with the epithalamium, which has to do with marriage. And there's a sort of sexual erotic element to marriage, of course. So he's removed this kind of implicit eroticism tied up with the mythology that you get in the Hypnerotomachia Polyphili with the aroused satyr. It's not there. So all this in mind, Giorgione is painting this and he dies. Done. He's out. All the while, in his artist circle, there is someone by the name of Tiziano Vecellio, better known to Anglophones as Titian. So Titian was born around 1490. He is the same generation as Giorgione. So if around 1510, that means Titian is about 20 years old. He had worked in Gentile Bellini's workshop, and then he moved into Giovanni Bellini's workshop, where we know Giorgione had learned to paint. So he meets Giorgione within the circles, and he's greatly influenced by Giorgione's style. We often identify Titian's early work with Giorgione's style. Okay, so after Giorgione's death in 1510, Titian takes off as the most prominent painter of the Venetian Renaissance and is probably the closest thing to a household name as far as Venetian artists go. Titian is going to be the most celebrated of them all.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Renaissance people, if you are enjoying the Italian Renaissance podcast, I have good news. We're now active on Patreon. You can show your love for the show by becoming a patron and get access to additional resources, information, and artworks. Better yet, those who join the Renaissance Master or Renaissance Patron tier will get access to at least one additional podcast episode each month. My goal is to ensure that the main podcast remains a free, accessible source for everyone. Become a patron today through the link in the show notes to support the continued production of new episodes and help build and maintain this community. The Italian Renaissance Shop is now also active on Etsy, linked in the show notes. Sport our logo or choose from a growing selection of Italian art-inspired designs. Discounts are offered to select Patreon tiers as well. Your support has my immortal gratitude. Now, enjoy the show. So, working together, learning from Giorgione, Titian is going to finish the Sleeping Venus, the Dresden Venus, okay? So what is he adding in? That weird pillow and landscape, right? So if we're looking at this, Titian is phenomenal at how he does his draperies and painting, and he loves a nice splash of bright, vibrant red. You see that in a lot of his paintings, and he's putting that in here. He's added this pillow, he's added this drapery, and you can kind of tell it's by a different hand when you look at it. And you can kind of also tell it was added after the fact, especially where her leg meets it. She's sort of not actually on it, and it looks like the landscape behind her is showing through the drapery. So it's executed beautifully, but there's some areas where your eye can kind of pick up that it's two artists' hands. It's not just Giorgione. It's Giorgione and it's Titian. But Giorgione is responsible for this erotic pose, okay? The other thing that Titian adds to this is a figure of Cupid. And like Professor Schmitter told us in the last episode, everything by Giorgione has been put under thorough x-rays and different types of technical studies. This revealed the Cupid, and it turns out that the Cupid was recovered by a restoration in the 19th century, which is something that happens a lot. They crop paintings to fit into frames. They paint over, figures. They, you know, really kind of wonky restoration. Not that we don't do it in this century too, just not to that kind of detrimental scope. So Titian's Cupid is in there. What does Cupid add to a composition? If he's associated with Eros, and Eros is the element of love that is erotic, those symbols are automatically being read. Not that this painting needs any additional figures to represent that sort of eroticism, but that was part of the historical contribution of Titian to this painting that was covered up and left covered up from the 19th century. I already want to kind of depart from Giorgione's final work, The Sleeping Venus, and I think we've adequately covered his career and works. Not that there aren't many more to talk about, but three episodes on Giorgione, I think, is sufficient to understand his impact, his use of poetry in his art, and really important that he was the primary influence for Titian, okay, who, of course, is most famous for his Venus of Urbino. And you might have already had this painting in mind when you saw Giorgione's Sleeping Venus, because, of course, Titian is going to, in a sense, recreate it, but not for another couple of decades. The Venus of Urbino was done at about 1538, right? If we're 1510 for the Sleeping Venus, 1538 for the Venus of Urbino, it was commissioned for Guidobaldo II della Rovere, Duke of Urbino, okay? The Venus of Urbino, that's why it is called that, and it was in Urbino, right? So what's happened in this painting? What's the difference? What are we trying to look at here? The reclining figure's moved inside, right? So she's inside of what seems to be a semi-classic but Renaissance palazzo. She is again reclining, but she's awake and she's looking right at you. She is inviting you in, okay, to the painting, to the scene, to this no longer a landscape, but this kind of domestic scene where we still see that phenomenal modeling in the draperies, which is actually pushed back now, and she's actually laying on them the way that the eye would perceive that. And again, that nice splash of red is actually on the bed underneath the white. Okay. Very similar composition. The arms come down and she's holding flowers. Okay. Her very, very I heard it described as creamy. I wouldn't say creamy body, but I thought that was a little funny. Her pale complexion contrasts with this really black kind of backdrop. It wants you to see her form and her hand, which comes around the same way it did in the Sleeping Venus, just slightly more suggestive. I will say it is important that in the period, these perceptions were the same. And the Duke of Urbino, Guidobaldo della Rovere, had a curtain to conceal it before he would show it off, just because of the potential of it being deemed indecent. Now, there's other really important elements of this. So we're inside. I keep saying that. We're inside. Okay, we get it. There is a dog at her feet. Now, dogs are, of course, standard symbols of fidelity. And what are these two people doing in the background? They are rummaging through what is called a cassone. A cassone, a kind of trunk. And these are typically associated with marriage gifts. Okay, so there are hints about fidelity and marriage and eroticism, the same exact things that we saw in the Sleeping Venus but in references to poetry about marriage. So he's carrying all these modes over. He's enhancing the eroticism. He's making them his own. And this is, of course, one interpretation of many. What I do want to stress is that this is not, it can be in a class, a kind of classical art nude and be erotic and be fine art, and that's okay. I don't want us to pretend that fine art can't be erotic, because of course it can. Okay. Often comes up in terms of this painting is the author Mark Twain, who was traveling around and wrote a text called A Tramp Abroad in the 1880s. He also, of course, did The Innocents Abroad, documenting his travels. And he writes extensively about art, and he writes extensively about the Uffizi Gallery, where, by this time, the Venus of Urbino was on display. And I'm going to read from his text what his impressions in 1880 was of the Venus. Now, keep in mind, Mark Twain is very funny. So we're not really talking about some snobby critic here. I want us to read it with a sense of humor. Quote, "You enter and proceed to that most visited little gallery that exists in the world, the Tribune, the Tribune. And there, against the wall, without obstructing rag or leaf, you may look your fill upon the foulest and vilest, the obscenest picture in that the world possesses, Titian's Venus. It isn't that she is naked and stretched out on a bed. No, it is the attitude of one of her arms and hand. If I ventured to describe that attitude, there would be a fine howl. But there the Venus lies, for anybody to gloat over that wants to. And there she has the right to lie, for she is a work of art, and art has its privileges. There are pictures of nude women which suggest no impure thought. I am well aware of that. I am not railing at such. What I am trying to emphasize is the fact that Titian's Venus is very far from being one of that sort. In truth, it is too strong for any place but a public art gallery. Titian has two Venuses in the Tribune. Persons who have seen them will easily remember which one I am referring to." Whew, end quote. What, he's really making a kind of funny, a hilarious commentary about the privileges of art over writing, right? He says, if I ventured to describe that attitude, talking about of her hand, there would be a fine how, saying, I'm not allowed to actually write what I'm seeing. Because writing this out is a faux pas, right? But painting it and displaying it for anyone to see, and he does talk about, you know, young people in the gallery and this sort of thing, it's fine to hang this on the wall. It's just not fine to write about. And that's playing with the kind of give and take of what the nude is. The nude form is in art, in visual art. And Mark Twain is complaining, I guess, or making a kind of statement about the difference between art and literature and what art space, especially the art gallery, not just art itself. It is too strong for any place but a public art gallery. And I think that's very true, but also quite funny. So that is more or less everything that I have to say about the Venus of Urbino history-wise. There are a million interpretations. There are plenty of things that you can read about it. I do recommend looking at it, and with, you know, of course, a curious mind, right? So with that, I do want to transition to this later part, which really has the Venus of Urbino in mind. And I want to talk a little bit about all of the awesome feedback that I got from you guys and how I'm going to address those things and what the show is going to look like moving forward, and even answer some questions from you guys, indirectly, in a sort of way. So if you guys recall, I did a Lamentations episode where I complained about museums and academia and all of that fun stuff. And quite frankly, I got an email about it from a charming person that criticized my characterization of the Venus of Urbino. And with good reason. And I went back and I listened. I realized the Lamentations episode was like this episode. It was like I was running out of time. I was swamped and I did something off script. And I said blatantly, and here's another graphic content warning. I said, if you want to go see the Venus of Urbino masturbate, you know, this, then go, you can go right ahead. And what I was doing was being sarcastic about the attitudes in the art gallery. In the same way Mark Twain was, that, you know, if your singular understanding of the Venus of Urbino is that her fingers are doing something precarious and you have to go see that, then I was complaining about that mentality in the Uffizi, in the art gallery. I was not making a definitive stance that that is what she is doing, even though I am very, very, very on the side that this is an erotic image, and I believe that to be the case. So I got some pushback from that, and I just wanted to address that here. Not that I think, I just think maybe my humor didn't carry over, my sense of humor, my point didn't carry over, really trying to explain that painting, not singularly for the erotic sense. There is all of these symbols about marriage and fidelity that kind of speak to the Renaissance mind at the time, but also the history in Urbino and why would the Duke want that. And there's a lot to say about it beyond that point, especially as it relates to Titian's history with Giorgione and the Sleeping Venus. I think those are important connections well beyond the kind of cursory, like, ha-ha scope of the painting, which is really a phenomenal an exciting work of art that is erotic or not, just an absolute gem to behold. So my apologies if that didn't carry over the way it was supposed to. So I also got the request to do book reviews and maybe kind of some insight on my bibliography. I'm working on expanding the show, and that is actually coming in the next couple weeks, to more of a... To include more of these smaller things, and more on that in the future. So don't worry. I know that some people want those things, and I'm working on that. And I have a lot of time this summer to do so. And, I did get a specific request to cover Niccolo Machiavelli. I do a lot of art, but I don't want this to be only an art history podcast. I've done a lot of literature studies, just not a lot of political studies. I've read Machiavelli, of course, but I don't have mastery over his concept. So I will, once we're done with Venice, because that's where we still are, and we're only at 1510 now, and we've got a few more episodes that we're going to cover some of these really important artists in Venice, and other things in Venice, which gets me to the next request that I got was about... I got a review on Apple, and I'm just going to read part of it. So it's Jean, or it's Jean, I wasn't actually sure which one. It says, I'd love to see an episode regarding the intellectual developments in the Italian Renaissance, such as the printing press, or maybe an episode on women's literature referencing Christine de Pizano, Lucrezia Marinella. Okay, so in Venice, Aldus Manutius, or Aldo Manuzio, developed a printing press, and Venice became the hot center of printing in Italy. So I did discuss this with the Hipternomachia Polyphili. I plan to cover Aldus Manutius and printing as part of the Venetian Renaissance after I'm done talking about Islam, because that's really, really important in Venetian Renaissance. As far as women's literature, definitely Christine de Pizan is Venetian. She's medieval. And I did Dante. So if I did Dante, I suppose I can do Christine de Pizan. Lucrezia Marinello, 16th and 17th century, is a little bit later than our scope. I think she's more Baroque, but she kind of the defense, the, what does she write? The superiority of women over men. In response to this gruesome text about the superior of men over women, I think that was Marinella. Maybe it's something we could get into. I would be more inclined because we talk so much about Petrarch, Petrarch's mode of writing carries over into women writers, Gaspara Stampa out of Padua, which is part of Venetian territory, and of course the most famous early modern Italian author, Vittoria Colonna, in terms of women writers, who also wrote a very erotic canzoniere for her deceased husband. So there's a lot to say about them. I think Gaspara Stampa and Vittoria Colonna at least will be covered. In fact, I can make that a priority. So something to think about, that I am not leaving out the women, and I don't intend to, even though here we are talking about naked Venuses painted by men. I'm not leaving out the actual productions of women. So stay tuned for more on that. So I'm sorry this wasn't more formal, and for the summer, I plan to dedicate a lot of time to growing the show and to putting out some high-quality episodes. So stick with me. I'm still working on this, and now that the semester's over, things will be a little better. Of course, as usual, follow us on Facebook, like us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook. Please leave the show a review. As you can see, I read these. They matter to me, and they affect what's going to happen in the show. So keep doing that. It's really useful for me. Again, anyone who's individually contributed to the show through the link in the show notes, you guys save my life and you keep this thing afloat. I really appreciate that. And if you would like to do so, you can just click the support link and help us out. I want to thank you all for tuning in. And if you want to send me some angry mail about these two, please do. I appreciate all of the feedback. Until next time, my dear followers, arrivederci.